Today we saw some of the Hasidus, the Gdole Hasidus and so on. I'd like to talk about Hasidus in Hungary and what was unique about it and so on. So in 1735, Rabbi Yisrael Baal Shem Tov started to become known. I guess that's sort of given as the year of his galus, when he became known and people heard of him and so on. 1735. It was Ukraine.
Oh, Ukraine.
Ukraine, actually not that far from that area, Carpathian Mountain area and so on. And what?
Not so far from
where we were. Further that corner over there. Now, he himself was, I guess, an enigma, because each of his Talmidim, or even the third generation of Talmidim, were very different. There was a common denominator, but very different. And each country got the type of leader, Hasidic leader, that they needed, wanted, or didn't want, but that's what happened. So Hungary did not have much of Hasidus. It's surprising, but Hungary did not have many Hasidic forces in the beginning. For a long time, it was sort of somnolent. It was quiet. There was not much Hasidic stuff doing. The first Hasidic Rebbe was the Kalever. Now, there are Hasidic stories where the Baal Shem Tov came down into Hungary and he helped people and started somehow. I don't know. Those are stories that, you know, I have no way of vouching, not vouching. They're all, but Tachlis, what we know basically, what's there is the Kalever Rebbe. And his story is very typical of what would happen. Most, like we said before, most of the people living in that area were farmers, not terribly learned, and simple folk. They actually were very typically like everybody else. The Kalever Rebbe was born, and he was a shepherd of ducks. I don't know what they call them. I'm not sure what a duck person is, but that was his, and it was somebody, he raised them. He raised ducks. Yes, he was one. Sorry. Geese, or ducks, whatever. Yeah, it was a very heavy, and he was a typical boy, and one of the Hasidic Rebbes, Reb Leib Saras, he wandered around, he discovered him, and felt that he was a very special neshama. He took him back to Reb Shmelka in Nikolsburg, in Moravia, and that's where he was raised by, and came back to Hungary later to open up a Hasidus. Now, to get a sense of what the issues were and what was going on, one of the big problems was people became like the neighbors, and dancing, mixed dancing, especially at weddings, was very common. They have a big ring of men and women, they'd have square dancing of men and women. That was common. He became the Rebbe, the Kalever Rebbe, and he made a law. He was very popular. People liked him. He was warm. He was very musical. And he made the gunim, and we'll talk about two of them in a minute. And he made a law that anybody who gets married, he has to be Mesarek Kedushin and be Mesamer personally at the wedding. And you couldn't marry two people at one time in one night, because, you know, he needed to be there. He would come at the weddings. He would compose the gunim. He would sing and play. And he would organize the dancing the way he saw fit, and that's how he sort of got things right. His type of approach was very folksy. So, for instance, Hasidus in Poland took on a very sharp intellectual bent, where there was pshischa, cuts, etc. It took on a very folksy type of Hasidus. It was like the classical storybook Hasidus, and he took shepherd Hungarian folk tunes and made them into Jewish songs. He has two very famous songs. He was Megayer them. it's like there's an expression in in Yiddish Hebrew that people are kind of with Shinu Hashem or with Shinu Maisa, like people work over somebody else's material. One song is very famous and it became like almost the anthem of his group and all and the Hungarian Chassidim. It's called Sola Kokosh. It has a very, it's a very powerful, moving song. If you don't know Hungarian, it's very moving. The words basically means the sun is up, the hen is crowing, the geese are walking about. That's the flavor of, those are the words that the words are. They sort of gave it the air of meaning. The Bria is waking up. Ribbono Shalom, Lama Zaftanu, where are you? Come. So he took a type of song that was very, very folk song, and he used the same type of tune, and the words are the same. And when Hungarians get together, when that genre get together and sing it, it's very powerful, very, very. People like singing together. It is very. I unfortunately for you, I can't sing, so I'm not going to even try to sing it. But if you ever download it, you'll download it. It's a very beautiful and powerful song. But the words are very. It's a type of stuff a farmer would sing and so on. The second song of his that's very famous is, it's a love song, of a simple farmer. It goes. Far as, how big are you? My rose, you're all lost in the forest. Where are you? If the forest was small, I'd find my rose and so on. He interpreted it, so he had that stanza. And then the next stanza was, Gullus, Gullus, you are so vast. Shchina, Shchina, you are so small. If only the forest was a little more scattered, I'd be able to find you. And a whole bunch of stanzas, again, using the type of natural music and folk and giving it that type of meaning. So the Kalover was that first Chassidus, and it was the simple folk Chassidus, taking natural motifs of nature, people, the type of song, and bringing it into Kedusha, like you do with the dancing and so on and so forth. The second person who came to Hungary to found the Chassidus, so the Kalover was born. There is a Kalava dynasty. One of them is still Admei of Esrim. Again, I don't think they're direct descendants. They're sort of great nephews of sorts. One of them lives in Eretz Yisrael. He is a very, unfortunately has no children, but he does a lot of activities. He goes and speaks in places. He founded to memorialize the Holocaust for Frum people, and he's made books on it, two books on it, stories. He comes, when he speaks, he also sings. A very, very folksy type of rebel, like you expect.
Is he the one without the beard?
Yes, he's the one without the beard. The other one, he must be in his mid-90s, is he?
Sure.
The other one is in America. He was the one in America is a very, he worked with youth a lot.
Yes.
He spoke at us in our yeshiva, and he dealt with young people a lot and their problems. He unfortunately has Lou Gehrig's disease, and he is basically immobile, but he still runs around being makar of people and reaching out to people. That's Kalov. The next one was what we saw this morning was the Rav Teitelbaum, the Yismach Moshe. He himself was a big, he was a misnagid in Galicia, grew up in Galicia, was a misnagid, was a Talmud Chacham, became influenced by the Chos of Lublin, became a Rebbe, and came to Hungary to establish a Hasidus. He did similar things, very different than him.
Very unusual.
No, well, many Rebbes, Reb Tzadik HaKohen, were misnagdim. They met whoever it was, they met their match, and somebody convinced them, and they turned around. It didn't happen much the other way, but it did happen that way. So, that was he became known as a very big tzaddik. Now, his personal Seder Hayom, his personal day looked like this. He woke up 5 o'clock in the morning always. He would have shiurim. He would drink a little wine and cake. Would daven until 2, 3 in the afternoon. Receive people who needed brachas. Have another shiur. Daven until midnight, and after midnight we have his first meal of the day. That was his Seder Hayom, and yes, yes, that, you know, waking up 5 in the morning is difficult, but it's a lot more difficult when you and you know, he was a recognized Talmud Chacham by everybody. However, his big activity for helping people was kemeis, which means that he would write amulets and give it to people in need of a bracha. And he would say, he would write the amulet, and he would say, I'm giving it to you because the Rebbeinu Shlom can help you, and this is how he's going to help you. Now, he felt, because these were simple people, this was the type of thing they were into. It's a very, very mystical type. People were into it. This is Carpathians. This is what people think. The Lahavdol, the Goyim thing like that. He needed to give them charms, amulets, or something, and use that as a vehicle to get them to be a lot more, you know, religious. Look, Hashem is helping you, and here it is. It met opposition. First of all, the memory of Shabtai Tzvi was fresh. Shabtai Tzvi was 200 years before that. He was the 1600s, and we'll see in Prague when we get to there that it's a very important. It smelled too much of, you know, a kind of abracadabra stuff, and there was this nagdus to it, and people spoke out against him, and they pushed back against it. Not his folks people like this type of stuff, but the people from Slovakia. There are two tshuvas written, the Chassam Sofer, and we'll see tomorrow, Mishra, when we speak more about Chassam Sofer, who was the key person in that part of Hungary. Chassam Sofer tolerated, but he was very annoyed with the amulet stuff, and he was annoyed with one more thing. They had a chumrah by many Hasidim, but he was one especially, not to wear any wool garments, because they couldn't check for shatness. Those days, the checking for shatness was kind of primitive, and you had to trust the guy that he's not going to put any flax in it. So there were too many issues with it, and he paskened, but he said the following.
And
the Rav Teitelbaum, the first one, Rav Teitelbaum, the first. And he said, anyone who davens Nusach Sfard, Nusach Sfard is a very holy Nusach, and it's allergic to wool. And if you daven Nusach Sfard, you cannot wear wool garments, except for a talis, obviously.
That's the way he phrased it.
Yes, he said it has a special Kedusha, and it doesn't tolerate wool begadim. Now, the Chassam Sofer wrote a tshuva on it. The tshuva goes like this. He was very annoyed with that formulation. And he said, first of all, they didn't like the Davening Nusach Sfard as a change. He said, halachically, you can be somech on wearing wool clothing. It's a small chash. If somebody wants to be machmir and wear only linen clothing, that's a very worthy chumrah for somebody who's holding there, and that's fine. But to say that it's something with Nusach Sfard is absolute rubbish. And peddling rubbish is not something we should do. So with all due respect, nice to be machmer, you want to have Nusach Sfard, okay. That anyone has shaykhs with the other one, it's absolute nonsense. He wrote it quite, for Chassam Sofer, it was quite sharp way he wrote it. And there was some tension. There was some sort of unhappiness with it. But that was the type of thing. Those were the two early Rebbes. And Kalev, very little remained of it. It sort of was a Volkshochschule. Teitelbaum became eventually his grandson was very famous. His great-grandson, nephews, Atzichaim, different branches. And the Satmar Rebbe is like a fifth or sixth generation from those Teitelbaums. They met him. Now, besides that, there was one other Hasidus that took hold in Hungary, and that was Munkacs. Munkacs comes from Dinev Yichas, but they became a lot more, and Munkacs and Rav Teitelbaum became famous for being Kanaim. We'll talk about that in a moment.
Kanaim.
What? Kanaim. Now, there was two or three more Hasidic courts that had a lot of influence. The Divrei Chaim Galitzia from Sanz, he influenced a lot of people, sent Rabbanim, but there was never a court officially. Divrei Chaim did. What?
Sanz was also
Galitzia, but they influenced. In other words, there was traffic, there were people coming and going, and finally bells had, because they were close to Galicia, they sort of had Rabbanim who might be Belzers and things of that nature. What Vishnitz. Now, some of the things that were unique about Hungarian Hasidus. So part of the Hasidus became extreme Kanoim. Satma and Munkach held that Satma is to the left of him and he was to the right of Satma, believe it or not. They, what?
Again?
Munkach,
the right of Satma.
Yes. He said that the fact that the Satma Rebbe is anti-Zionist raises a doubt in his mind if he should be anti-Zionist. But he says, what can you do? He said, if he davens, I'm not going to stop davening. They were at loggerheads. Munkach felt he was the biggest kanoi against Zionism. Why it is that they were particularly, Satmar itself, the Teitelbaum family, were extraordinarily strong-minded. Whatever they held about, they're very strong-minded. I want to add another piece that people don't realize. Hasidus in Hungary was different than in Poland and in the parts of Litta, the few parts that it took on, or in other places. For instance, Ger Hasidus is a movement. It's an ideology. It's a way of life. The Rebbe is a Rebbe. You could live 500 miles from there and say I'm a Ger Hasid because there was a Hasidus. Hasidus was an ideology, a movement with a certain way of putting life together. Rishin was like that. Chabad was like that. And Lechvich was in the various, that was like that. The Hungarian Hasidus was nothing like that. If you were a Munkacher and you did not live in Munkach, there's no Munkacher Hasidus. There was a Munkacher Rav. Most of they would call themselves a Rav. Satman was called Rav. Only in America where they didn't have that. And if you didn't live in one of the Satman communities, it meant, so you traveled maybe like, just like we went to Kerestir to get a bracha or to write a kvittel. It doesn't make us Kerestir Hasidim. There is no Kerestir Hasidus. He was a holy man, did wonderful things, and you know, we get brachas. So people might come for a bracha, they might, but there was no such thing. It was, that's why the typical Hungarian Rebbe was called a Rav, and the Rabbanim had a Hasidus trapping to it, but they never had a Hasidus in the way that the other Rebbes had. So it was when people speak of Satmar Hasidus, there is no Satmar Hasidus. There is a Satmar Rav, and it's a community. It's a community with a leader, and when the leaders were not leading, there was nothing different about Munkach Hasidim, the Satmar Hasidim, except that they disliked each other. But there wasn't anything in terms of, it was communities. And that's a very big difference. It was a very big difference in the way how they went about things and so on. I'm going to speak a little bit about Satma. What? It hasn't changed because if you ask a Satma Chas, what? So today, because towns are very, it used to be, and a lot of the fights in towns would be, who does this town belong to? Is this town belong to this Rav or this Rav? Like the main town belonged, so Spinka belonged to Spinka Rav, obviously Munkach belonged to Munkach Rav, but who did a suburb belong to? It was a dynasty so you could be a Gerachas no matter where you lived. You couldn't be a Munkach if your town was not Munkach. It was a very different type of Hasidus, a very different type of structure. Sorry, what?
I'm really getting the nuance here of what a community means versus an ideology.
Ger has what to say about how to learn, how to daven, how to act. There's a lot in the Hasidus that teaches you about how to put the piece of Yiddishkeit together. So a Ger Hasid will learn X, will daven in a certain way, quicker, longer. It's an ideology or a way of a package for Yiddishkeit. There's nothing like that in Satma. Satma is the Rav, And on particular issues, he had very strong opinions. But that's it. There is nothing about Satma davening. What is Satma davening? There is nothing you can't... Ger has a very clear message about how to daven. Satma is daven warm and strong, and come to the Rebbe for Yontif. It was a leader of a community. There wasn't an ideology. It was very different. And that's why Satma is just a catchword, because nobody else was left from Hasidus, and the Satma Rav was a very powerfully charismatic person. All of the communities in Williamsburg became satellite communities
of Satma.
That's what happened.
It was by default.
The way many, there was very little leadership left over, and everybody lived in one place. It wasn't as if everybody lived. This one lived in Debrecen. This one lived in Munkach. This one lived. What, Makara?
Me.
Now. We saw something very fascinating today that was very interesting. We saw one Rebbe, the Rebbe Shaila Kerstier, one figure whose message was accepting everybody. And I think everybody was moved by it. Come in as you are, like she described this woman who came in, and Shaila Kerstier came the lowest of the low. It's something out of a Kalbach story. The Satmar Rav comes across to us as being almost the exact opposite. It's very, very judgmental, very powerfully so. And the truth is, HaKadosh Baruch Hu has many, many midos, and each one of them is a different. If it's genuine, and if it comes with not out of personal spite or whatever it is, it's something that that's needed. Somebody has to say welcome everybody, and somebody has to say this is right and this is wrong. It's true that they went with their temperament, but I always tell people when we speak about chinuch, a child needs a father and a mother. I said this way before they had other type of arrangements, and the reason is there's one message that's important for a child. There are consequences. If you didn't do X, and we spoke about this half a dozen times, there's no trip for you, not this or not that. A child also needs a voice. But just this once, it's so important, and he wants to come. He'll make up for it afterwards. It's healthy and necessary to have those two messages, and that's why there's a father and mother. Sometimes the woman does one of the messages. Sometimes the woman does one message and the father another. You can ask my when we're not around. You can ask Yaakov which one gave which message at what time. Who gave the patch and who and organized the reconciliations. But otherwise than that, it is. And let's talk about this. And let's talk about Zionism, because that was the elephant in the closet.
But if you say that there was a difference between Munkach and Satmar in the Kenos way, why didn't that make the difference between them? If there was a difference between them.
I think it was just a personal thing. I don't think they're... It's hard to know. They were both vehemently anti-Zionist. And now...
They didn't have machloikas in something specific.
Hard to believe. I don't know. I'm not aware of anything. But... let's just go through it. Zionism was a very powerful force. And it's something that included much positive and real issues. It's like when somebody hugs you and the person has problems. So there's friendship, there's good, and there are problems. And to get a full picture, you need to get both. Eretz Yisrael, who's not turned on by Eretz Yisrael? That the life here was wretched and people needed to move on, that was obvious. That Klal Yisrael needed Geula was obvious. That Eretz Yisrael is where every Jew yearns to be. And if we can build it, that's wonderful. Those things, I think, were. But the message that came along with it in the loudest voice was, we're going to reorganize Judaism. Judaism will stop being a religion. It'll start becoming a nation. And then they said, Hungary has their own country after World War I. Bulgarians have their own country. Jews will have their own country. But our understanding of who we are is not Bulgarians, not Albanians. We are God's people. Eretz Yisrael is conditional. It's not that we live in Eretz Yisrael and we do it's sometimes better, sometimes worse. Hashem said part of life is going to be we're back together when our relationship is okay and we're not back there when it's not. So Zionism, as a, in its most secular version, was very powerful. And there was a message in Klal Yisrael, look at what's great about it. Jews finally realized they can't become Hungarians. They must live on their own. There was a powerful positive message, we can't assimilate. There was a negative message about what it means to be a Jew. A Jew doesn't mean just living in a particular place and speaking a particular language. It means recognizing you have a covenant with Hashem. And no one person could give that message clearly. Again, I'm reading Hashgacha Kadosh Baruch Hu's, you know, how he did it. So one person said, children, Eretz Yisrael. And one person said, what does this all mean? What these people mean is not what it should mean to them. The voices were quite strident. They were difficult. And I don't, you know, it's not as if I found it easy. But I think without a powerful voice saying, think twice and don't just flow along with it, we might have, who knows how much we would have lost religiously and so on. So you had voices where everybody's welcome, embrace you as you are because Hashem loves you, and a voice that says if Hashem loves you means you have to earn some trust. You know, a message of I accept you as you are is not a positive message unless it comes with, and let me tell you what you could be. Somewhere along the line we needed, and I believe Klal Yisrael is better because we have two plus many messages. Just like we spoke this morning, there needs to be a message that Torah is about understanding, and needs to be a message that's about, it's about feeling and living it. And so as difficult as Satmar is, and as difficult as some of the rhetoric is, but in the big picture, it came from the heart of the heart of a person who was a big tzaddik, someone who was a really extraordinary person, recognized by everyone for many things. And for me, who's not that, it's still a voice that I need to hear. And caution, a sign of caution. You know, one second before you proceed, think twice or three times or four times. So I think for most of Klal Yisrael, it's become a sort of, by having tension, it's like when you stretch a sheet to make it flat. When people pull on different sides, as long as they're not tearing up the sheet, it will become smooth. I think it's a lot of that in the big picture. That's how I would view it.
Not that it was a message for them and it's not relevant today. It was still relevant.
I certainly don't think it's relevant today because even Zionism has become a very tempered message. People living in Israel today live in a country. They live in a country. It irks me when people feel they must spend time talking about it, because I don't think that that's the issue that bothers anybody. You know, when people speak, even if you're big Hanoi, Israel's a country, people are no longer into the dream of it. It's just Eretz Yisrael is Eretz Yisrael. The one who tells the most people to move to Eretz Yisrael is Chaim Kanievsky. People are scared to go in for bracha because every other person, he says, move to Bnei Brak, move to Eretz Yisrael. When I come, he asks me, why am I watching D.C.? Like, so I stopped coming. I learned my lesson. It's dated. It's just hanging on to something that's not because the kanos changed, but that's not the burning issue today. And neither is the army. The army was once upon a time a very powerful attractor, and you came into the army frum and you left fry. It's not the case anymore. In both sides, it doesn't. Kids are not goggle-eyed about it, and many non-religious people avoid the army. It doesn't have the allure it had, and Baruch Hashem today, many from people do well in the army. So it doesn't have. You need to keep track. The Yetzirah doesn't. The Yetzirah doesn't get antiquated. The Yetzirah keeps moving forward. You know, there's much more Yetzirah coming up, but you know, that's the way it is. That's the Salkapanim. So it's important to understand that the Hasidus in Hungary took on a flavor that fit the country. The Rebbe was a big tzaddik, made many mofsim, yeshuas, welcomed the poor and the simple folk, very much closer to what the Baal Shem Tov's kind of original type of Hasidus might have been. And people were that way. And by and large, the Hasidus remained that type of thing. It was, and it took on a more communal structure. The Rebbe was the roof of the town. The people came from wide and far to ask for brachas and yeshuas, and that was Hasidus over there. We'll see tomorrow. Some Sofa was a much more halachist person. They were not into that, and it caused some tension. But they, at the end of the day, they stayed with it.
How did Nusach Sfard?
So Nusach Sfard evolved as follows. Hasidim wanted to daven the Rebbes with having all of the kavanos, all of the thoughts that Kabbalah has to put into davening. So the sefer that lists what a person should be thinking while he's davening was written by the Arizal, was a Sfardi. So a Rebbe opens up a book, the Arizal's sefer. It says in it, you should be thinking these and these thoughts at these and these words, and he doesn't have those words in a sitter. So what do you do? So they grafted the Sfard words into Nusach Ashkenaz, and they created what's called Nusach Sfard. So it's a hybrid to help give people the kavanas they needed to give. So that's when Nusach Sfard came, and it met resistance because it was changing things. That's what it was about. Yeah. So for these people, everybody has their bridge to Hashem. For the simple folk, the miracle worker was the bridge to Hashem, and that's why he gave out these kamayas and he said, "You'll see, you know, you'll be helped."
How could things work? I mean, like, how does it?
You were sitting this afternoon, listening to stories. Your eyes were wide open.
No, I know. But
and so am I. You know what? It helps. It's a piece of the puzzle. When you live off that, that's all it's about. You're missing a lot of other stuff, but it's a piece to it. To have this.
Is it the same concept as Nechash and Nechashis?
Looking at Hashem. Right. It takes you out of the usual, and it takes you out of your mode of everything is fixed. When you live in a rational world, everything is frozen, fixed. It is what it is, and this is what the doctor said, this is what my boss said, this is what the lawyer said. So it's helpful every so often to get a shot in the arm and say, Afal Pi Kein. When you live just off that, it removes you from the natural world you should be living in. It turns Yiddishkeit into just kind of a shaman of sorts, and it's a problem.
That's why Chizkiyahu had to break it.
Right. It says that Moshe Rabbeinu had the snake of compass so that people would look at it, and then they would remind themselves of Hashem. Chizkiyahu saw people worshipped it, and it became a worship of it comes up. So he broke it. You know. Okay.
Nasty.
Societies were different. They were in Poland. People, there was a certain kanos, not kanos in this type of way, but you know, it struck a note. People looking for emes, kutsk, pshischa was a violently, I don't know if eichenklass is the right word, pshischa, where ger kutsk came from and ger came from. Their point was, be honest with yourself. And rolling your eyes and shaking back and forth is being dishonest. A hype is also dishonest. So their message was, be brutally honest with yourself until your last day, because when you get carried away in an ecstasy, in a religious ecstasy, you might mean it well, but that's not the real you. So Poland produced that type. Lithuania, which was basically Chabad and Lechwitz, they produced the more intellectual bent of trying to understand deeper stuff. Each society, I'm not sure why, but that was the, each society had its own mentality, and that's the bent it took.
Can I ask on a different topic question?
Yeah.
It's related to what you mentioned before. It's like Peter says, kfir like a question maybe. What?
Why is it that Silver Spring produce like Firidika type of people? Is there like, what's it about?
You mentioned about Chaim Kanievsky's
Yes.
Saying to people different things. A, was there such ever non-Hasidish Rav who said things like that that we can't explain? And how do we explain? How do we refer to it? And what does it mean? Rav Chaim Ganevsky says to a person, you should move to Bnei. What does it mean? That's
so
we should grow a beard.
We should grow a beard and a watch. Yeah. All this stuff. How do we? How do you understand?
Was
there anyone who did it before him?
It certainly was not. It was not part of the literature world. It is kind of new in that way.
Chafetz Chaim is mentioned. Chafetz Chaim did such thing.
Chafetz Chaim would say sometimes things that people didn't know what he wanted. I mean, people come back with stories that Chafetz Chaim said, but by and large, it was a rational approach. And if a person wants that approach, he shouldn't go to Chaim Kanievsky. On the other hand, I'll tell you a story that would explain the two halves of it. There was somebody who had a problem, a child with severe issues that needed some sort of chemical treatment, which was a real question: should they do it, should they not do it? And it was like a sort of a Yiddishkeit type of question: should they administer a certain type of drug to a child? So somebody went to Yosef Hutner, and Rav Hutner thought about it and he said, I can't decide this, ask Rav Shach. So he went to ask Rav Shach thought a moment and he said yes or no, whatever he said. So the boy's father said, can you explain to me the basis for it? He said, I can't explain, go to Rav Hutner to explain. So he went to Rav Hutner and Rav Hutner explained it to him. So he said, I don't understand, the Rosh Yeshiva explained me what Rav Shach said, so why did you send me there? He said, I can give you the rational background for both sides. To make a decision, I don't have the ability to weigh the sides. Rav Shach says, Urm v'tumim. He has an instinct about what's right, but he can't explain it. I can explain it to you, but I trust his instinct. There is something, it's like in business. You have the guy teaching a business course, and he can really explain why a certain deal worked, a certain deal not. That person is usually not a millionaire, It's unless he's teaching in Hungary, he gets a million florin. But he's not usually. And you have and a good businessman has a good sense, and you'll ask him to explain, and he says because it smelled right. Well, how does it smell right? I just felt that it was right. So there's a certain type of instinctive. And you can choose. If a person can, certain decisions a person chooses, and you choose. Do you want a rational approach? Go ask somebody who's going to weigh it that way. Do you want something beyond? Go to Chaim Kanievsky. And yes, I don't think we ever had anything like that, but it is what it is. We have, I was told about a story with my wife, and I told you the story of, I don't know who's. I went to Bnei Brak as a bacher with my roommate, Rabbi Paul Shmulevitz. He's a rabbi in Toronto, was a Chaim Shmulevitz's nephew. So we had a list of what to do in Bnei Brak. We go to Stipler, we go here, we go there. We went to Stipler. Stipler couldn't hear. And you had to yell and scream. So we go in, and yes, his name was Shmulevitz. He said, oh, you're Chaim's nephew, Chaim Shmulevitz's nephew. So he says, yes. Oh, very nice. How's he doing? How's he feel? Then he turns to me and he says, you also. So I was really lit back and I said, I'm going to tell him no. So I'm going to have to scream and yell no. To try and scream Lopiansky that he could understand, there's no way in the world can understand. It'll take up 5 minutes of it and I'm out. What a waste of time. So I nodded. Then I had a piece of Torah I had prepared to write and written, and he looked at it, he commented on it. We asked for Sfarim. He gave it to us, out. In and out, and that was it. That was the end of the story. A year later, I got engaged to my wife, and after the engagement, we took a walk, and she said, she's going to Bnei Brak. Her family lives in Bnei Brak. And I said, yeah, I was there a year ago, and I was by the Stipler. And I just realized I had become a nephew of the Stipler, of Reb Chaim Shmulevitz by marriage. I was engaged. So, and not only that, I became a nephew of the Stipler also through this engagement. So I told this story to Reb Nachum Pratsavitz, my Rebbe, as Litvak as they come. And he said, let me explain to you the meaning of this story. He says, it's not that when you walked in, the Stipel saw a sign, nephew of Chaim Shmulevitz, and he forwarded information to you. He said, when a big person says something, those words don't go to waste. They are. He said, the same thing happened with me. I came to the Mir Yeshiva. I was a young boy.
That's Reb Nachum.
Reb Nachum. Reb Leizudel asked me, who are you? And I said, my name is Nachum from Truk. I'm a son of Chakarov. It's a son of a Chakarov. Chakarov is like a son to me. You'll be my grandson. He said, all he meant was to be nice to me. I became his grandson. He married Reb Leizudel's granddaughter. So he said, it's not as if they have this voice or vision. When a big person says something, those words come true. So that's our perspective, and it's that's our perspective on these things. And
you said that's the way Rashi says it, right? That something that
nevuah nizak b'fiv. It's a gemara. Chazal, the Medrash says in a few places, nevuah nizak b'fiv. The person said something unintended, but Hashem put the words in his mouth. And when you don't have a rational way, a big person says something. When we were deciding about moving to Silver Spring, we decided, I'd asked the people who, and it was a very hard decision, and I decided to ask Rav Shach. And simply because I wanted somebody who could just say it. And without having, I just needed someone to say it. And three times, Rav Shach said, come, and then I got a message, he's not well, he had an operation, and he was really not doing well, and I didn't go, and that was that. But the people I spoke to, felt very strong that it's a good idea. But it was a very big decision, and the people you asked, you just...
I had a story. I went to the Rachmetz Rav Karevi in Bar Park.
Yeah.
And I went with a kvittel, with all the names of my family. At the time I only had a few kids. My parents, grandparents. And he read, it was a list of about 15 names. And he stopped at my grandfather's name. He turned to me and he says, so how was Yisrael Nussel? I happened to see my grandfather just had open heart surgery. And there was no way he could have known that. I didn't tell anybody, I didn't tell the gabbai, nothing. And I said, he's okay. And then he continued reading the names. And when you talk about the instinct, he had to have had an instinct.
Since Chabetz Chaim, I heard this from my Rebbe, Reb Zadel Epstein. He was my Rebbe in 11th grade, 12th grade. Very, very formative influence on me. He was a bacher, he learned in yeshivas in Grodno, and he went to Chavetz Chaim to ask for brachas. So he wrote down his whole family. He had a sister who had moved to America before they moved, and she was not religious anymore at the time. He didn't know about it. Nobody knew in the family about it. So he gave the Chavetz Chaim the whole list.
He didn't know himself.
He didn't know. She'd moved to America. She didn't tell her parents. She had married somebody who was less religious. They became not Shomer Shabbos. That was it. She later years, they came around again. Chabetz Chaim went through the entire list. He came to her name and he said, not everybody deserves a bracha. And he went on to the next. He told it to himself. And so I said, the real issue is, it's not that these things don't exist. The question is, what should your Yiddishkeit be built on? In other words, should the vast majority of it be the rational process of thinking things through and making decisions, or depending on a geyrel? And there was a fellow in Eishet Torah. A young man who I had the misfortune of having him the first year I was teaching. He got engaged. He was very frum, but his midas had been left way behind. His religiosity came way before that, and he had a very extreme personality. So, as a month after his wedding, his wife came running that there are real issues there. One of them was, he felt that, it says in the Mishnah, do not speak much with a woman, including your wife. So, not only didn't he speak with her, even like past the salt, he would grunt and motion like in Middle Shmones or something. And it began to create some issues at home. You understand that this is the type of thing that leads to issues. Some wives wish it, but he was. So I got hold of him, and I let him have it. And he was very upset with me. He also didn't buy his wife jewelry because it's a waste of money. She was a Sephardi girl, simple, wonderful, sweet person. So my wife took hold of him. She put him into a cab, went down with him to the jeweler and had him buy some jewelry. And I let him have it about the talking, and he was very angry with me. He avoided me like the plague. You know, he told me, the Vilna Gaon writes that he doesn't waste any words. So I said, the Vilna Gaon, I said, you're so far from the Vilna Gaon. I said, the Gedolim I know all have very normal family lives, and they talk with their wives, and it's a normal life. When you'll be holding way past there, then you'll be the Vilna Gaon. Whatever. So he avoided me, didn't talk about it, whatever, fine. One day he comes to me and he says, Baruch Hashem, what? I don't know, a few months later he comes with a big smile, Baruch Hashem, my problems have been solved. So what happened? He said they went to a mekubal, and he said the real issues in their marriage is because the gematria and the names don't work out well. So he added a name, subtracted the name, changed the name, and now the gematrias are okay. So I said to him, Uri, I said, I don't understand about these things much, but I sure hope it doesn't work. I said, your last chance of becoming a mensch was when you have to work it out with your wife and understand another person. I said, if this works, we got around the last hump of becoming a mensch, and you'll never be a mensch. I said, this is terrible. So the question is, how much of it, our sense of it is, unless a person is a living malach, he should be acting responsibly, thoughtfully. This, there are things in life when you say, this is Hashem's hands, and you look for something out of it. A chassidim, and there's room. So they say, we are too tachlis oriented. Where's the Ribbono Shel Olam, the world? Some things have to be left. Let's take a look, institutions, yeshivas. No yeshiva has the money in the bank account before they start. There's always an element of trust. Where's the gap between being irresponsible and trusting Hashem? It's hard. It's not easy. But no yeshiva ever said, well, I now have enough money for XY. Those yeshivas that did it that way were never successful. People had to push hard and have a vision of what's right to do, and then sort of, believe and understand if it's right. But what's the gap? When does it become something that you're just living on miracles and depending on miracles? And when is it? And when is it too balabatish? It's just like, I did some teaching for a fund that somebody left over. It's overfunded.